any secrets of the Mau Mau, this oath will kill me. If I am called in the night and refuse to come, this oath will kill me. If I see anyone steal white man's property, I must help him. I must hide what he gives me and say nothing, or this oath will kill me.
The whole system in this country, the economic system, is such that jobs are scarce. Automation is limiting jobs. It's decreasing jobs. And as automation eliminates the job opportunities, legislation will not create job opportunities. All it will do is bring about friction and hostility between the two races.
You see, there will be no progressive revival if black folks are not deeply involved in it.
I will obey all orders of the Mau Mau, or this oath will kill me.
I love that new intro. Shout out to Quinn. Quinn Turn with the new intro of the Mau Mau Hour. I had no idea Quinn was doing that. And I saw a message. Did you guys get the new intro for the Mau Mau? I'm like, intro for the Mau Mau. And he sends it to me. I'm watching it this morning. I was like, but thank you guys so much. Thank you for all the patrons that are watching right now. You guys are definitely the fuel in the TIR engine that keeps us moving. And definitely thank you everyone that's going to be watching on the replay. Thank you all the audio only listeners that'll be listening to this when it becomes an audio only podcast in a few days. Let me move out of the way and bring in my homie, my dog, Miami, Florida, weighing in at a whopping 225 pounds, offensive lineman from Hofstra by way of Boston University, the Pascal Robert.
Peace and greetings to the chat. Peace and greetings to the audience. Peace and greetings, Jason Miles.
I'm going to change your weight every time. This is just too much.
I like the aspirational weight. <issue. laughs>
She is the faceless voice of reason. What would this show be without this woman's contributions on the screen and all she does off the screen? She is the M2 Song.
Hello, hello to all the Barbenheimers out there.
Jesus. Have you seen that movie yet?
No. I would now. I have to see Barbie as well as Oppenheimer. It's a package.
It's a double feature. You know, the hair is pressed. I know you can go there and whip it and whip it all over the theater. Yes. They need to see you do that as you buy the popcorn. Be like, extra butter.
Extra butter.
Right? They have vegan popcorn there. And I will let Pascal introduce the guest before I move out of the way.
Today, we have on our show, this evening, I should say, one of the most profound intellectuals and thinkers of the late 20th and early 21st century, social critic of all things that are noxious to the consciousness of the liberators of society, injustice, and everything of that nature. A man who, for me, has been a sound voice challenging status quo politics in America overall, and even within the context of Black America. We have the well-respected, well-regarded intellectual, Dr. Cornel West.
Oh, my brother. I just want to begin by saluting you to Brother Pascal. Magnificent force for good that you are, but also saluting Jason and MT Sound as well. I know that they are part of the crew, the team, the collective, the comradeship that keeps this truth-telling site going, my brother.
I appreciate that. I just want to let you know, because I would not do justice to my mentors and teachers without mentioning that in the dark days where people were basically not supporting Bruce Dixon and Glenn Ford, who were giving vigorous challenge to the establishment president at that time, Barack Obama, you were one of the lone voices in the Black community that were outwardly supporting my friends and mentors who have thus passed away, Bruce Dixon and Glenn Ford, in their ever desire to expose the neoliberal sham that was that presidency. And I want you to know that there are people who remember you for that, who may not say it in public, but I am one of those people who remember you for that. And thank you for being loyal to those two men who had such an impact on my life.
No, but that's a beautiful thing. You know, Glenn and I used to break bread once a month right there on the Upper West Side at the French restaurant on 120th Street. He's a chain smoker, just like the great Sarah Vaughan. So I'd have to go outside. He was doing the lunch and just continue to talk, because I was just taking in the knowledge and the wisdom and the spirit. And he have a cigarette, go back in, start eating, have a cigarette again, go back in. But we did that for many years, man. I take a bullet for that brother, though. He's one of the great, he's the greatest revolutionary journalist, really, since Ida B. Wells, when you think about it. And I know T. Thomas Fortune and others were towering figures. But there's just nobody like Glenn, though, man. And you know his history in terms of the music, as well as being a revolutionary, his father heading the radio station that James Brown first bought down in Georgia. So we talk about James Brown and Rick James and Bootsy and George Clinton, let alone Aretha and things. He knew all of them. And then his own revolutionary intellect, it was such a powerful intellect that had the courage to tell very painful truths about both the Black bourgeoisie as well as the American empire. And he just was true. He was faithful unto death, man. He was true his whole life in terms of his calling and his integrity. And he always meant the world to me. And part of his spirit is at work inside of me. That's part of his afterlife at work in my own life, though, man. And you were there at the funeral, of course, and you knew the words that so many of us had to say to him and his family, his kids and so forth, with his wonderful sister and his nephew ran for office. I was there to support him, and he ran for office as well. No, Glenn, man, he's just a towering figure. I hope we never forget him. But you know how hard it is to focus in on the great figures in a moment of such overwhelming mediocrity and mendacity. It's like how people forgot about Paul Robeson so quickly. You know what I mean?
No, absolutely. No, that's we're going to talk about things to that effect.
Yeah, but right.
I prepared some questions for you, and I really want to hear your response to them, because I think some of them will be clarifying in many ways. So, Dr. West, the first question I have for you is, I don't know if you stated this publicly, or maybe sometimes you really don't feel the need to make such statements. What is your preferred economic model for society, Dr. West? Do you consider yourself a socialist, a capitalist, democratic socialist, or do you generally avoid such titles?
Well, I mean, I'm not an ism person because I'm trying to make sure that the least of these, that poor working people, those Sly Stone called everyday people, or James Cleveland called ordinary people, lift their voices like the Negro National Anthem. And that means to me a democratizing society all the way down. That's why when you think about self-respect, you think about self-determination, you think about self-defense, that comes from a bottoms-up orientation. And once you look at what does a democratic form of the economy look like, it doesn't look like a capitalist economy. Capitalism is not a democratic form of organizing at the workplace. It's hierarchical. And so I'm for workers' control. What does a democratic, a democratizing project look like from the vantage point of culture? Well, you've come from a hated and a terrorized and traumatized culture. You've got to have self-determination in terms of how you define reality, how you define yourself. And therefore, various kinds of self-determination, Black self-determination, worker self-determination, women's self-determination becomes very important. And certainly, there's no room for empire. That's why my very aim is to try to be head of the empire in order to dismantle the empire, right? And how do you dismantle the empire? You got to make sure that you are a people and nation among peoples and nations rather than an empire where other peoples and nations have to defer to you. So you can't reshape the whole world in your image and in your interest. That's what empires have done. There's been roughly 70 empires since the beginning of the species in Africa. The United States is the 68th, and this empire will come and go. All empires come and go. Most empires come and go because they got military outreach, corruption of their elites, the impotence of those inside of those empires, and the need for people to want to follow neo-fascist Pied Pipers to overcome the increasing domination and tyranny. And we see that all at work in the United States. Brother Glenn and I used to talk about this all the time. So that am I a socialist? Well, certainly there's a strong socialist dimension to what I'm talking about, but that's just a moment. You know what I mean? That's like asking, is John Coltrane or Donny Hathaway or is Phyllis Hyman a socialist? Well, there's elements, because when we raise our voices, we want to empower everybody and we want all lives to be able to flower and flourish. But we've got spiritual dimensions and we've got cultural dimensions that go far beyond isms, far beyond ideologies in that way. And so in that sense, I'm first and foremost a jazz man. You know what I mean? I'm a blues man, though, brother. Now, and, you know, I'm a revolutionary Christian, too. But I mean, the cross is all about the blues. The cross is all about catastrophe. And how do you fortify yourself in the face of catastrophe? Just like any great blues song, a blues songster. So, yes, I've always viewed myself as in solidarity with revolutionary socialists, no doubt about it. In the communist tradition, it would be closer to council communists than the vanguard communists. So that, you know, the Soviets without Bolsheviks, that was what happened at the Kronstadt Rebellion when they were crushed. Soviets are workers' organizations, whereas the vanguard parties were imposing their will upon the workers' organizations so that the workers' councils got crushed. So people like Panikok and Gorder, and it goes all the way up to Stanley Aronowitz, these are so-called council communists who become revolutionary socialists, critical of vanguard party orientation that imposes their will upon workers. That's very much my own tradition. Sinclair Drake, for example, is in that same tradition. He was in the American Workers' Party of 1937. A.G. Mustey's part of that tradition as well. So it's a long answer to your question in terms of if there's any ism. It's certainly a revolutionary socialist moment dimension. That's why I've been a socialist for the last 65 years, and I'm only, no, it's 55 years, I'm sorry, because I'm 70 now. But it's more than just that. I'm very much a free black man who is part of a blues tradition.
Well, I appreciate that really very elaborate answer to the question. And that's why I gave you the option to say that, you know, you didn't want to be categorized as either or any, as a matter of fact. So moving on, when was the exact moment you decided to run for president and what motivated that decision?
Well, you know, as I began to think of just how deep the decay is in the American empire and how undeniable the decline is of the American empire abroad. And I didn't see any voices that would have any visibility or saliency in the presidential discussion. And so when Brother Nick and the People's Party presented the possibility, I thought, prayed, pondered, and I said, you know, just to be able to raise one's voice, to try to tell some painful truths and bear witness to justice, and then acknowledge, given the level of the decay, you got neo-fascists and the Republican Party pushing us toward a second civil war, the neoliberal Bidens in the Democratic Party with their own authoritarian underlay with mass incarceration, and we're not even talking about the bombs dropping on the West Bank and other places, but they leading toward a third world war. So we got a choice between the second civil war at home and the third world war abroad. We've got to be able to raise some voices to bring some kind of reason, sanity, some kind of insight, some kind of compassion to this situation. You got the ecological catastrophe escalating every day on the corporate greed tied to fossil fuel companies. Hey, and then the white supremacy is always already working. So we're still getting killed by the police. Our children still having to deal with situations in the hood with indecent housing and decrepit schools and not enough jobs with a living wage. Economists telling us this economy is as good as it gets. As good as it gets with the grotesque wealth inequality. Workers still oftentimes having difficulty able to actually form unions with strong bite. And I'm talking about unions not in cahoots with the bosses, but unions that really have at the heart and core who they are, solidarity with their own workers. Patriarchal violence, attacks on precious trans and gay brothers and lesbian sisters. What are we talking about? As good as it gets. So that's so I then decided, I said, well, let me throw down. Let me make this leap, as it were. And I'm glad I did. I'm glad I did. I wish Brother Glenn were around because I need his counsel and his insight. But it's amazing to become this, you know, this menace and all of these other languages that's coming at me. I haven't had one public event. I'm beginning in Mississippi on August 25th. I was invited by the precious Emmett Till family to come down and be a part of the 68th anniversary of his vicious murder by cowardly white supremacists. We haven't had one fundraiser. And yet we get all of these various attacks and assaults and so forth. And when you get those kind of attacks and assaults and become a kind of, what some of my brothers and sisters are saying, wow, man, you really a threat. Brother like me a threat? No, it ain't me at all. I'm just a small little moment in a rich tradition of a great people that tried to tell the truth about the callousness and the indifference and the ways in which predatory capitalist processes obsessed with profit are crushing people and trying to make sure that working and poor people are able to straighten their backs up, and especially Black people able to straighten their backs up and bring critiques to bear on a Black bourgeoisie that's become so accommodating to a corporate-dominated status quo and a corporate-dominated Democratic Party and an increasing neo-fascist Republican Party, Black middle-class leadership itself often getting in the way of what our dear Brother Glenn called the misleadership class. That's his own construction of misleadership class, echoes of E. Franklin Frazier's great critique of the Black bourgeoisie in 1957, though he wrote it in French in 55, but it came out in English in 57. But so that all of that, I think, has to be made available more and more to the people, because the people are hungry and thirsty for the real thing, as Ashford and Simpson would put it. Ain't nothing like the real thing. You got all of these fakes and phonies and frauds out there acting like they on the they in the vanguard of struggle for justice. No. Do you know who Stokely Carmichael? Do you know who Bobby Hutton was? Do you know who Erica Huggins? Do you know who, we can go on and on and on. Do you know who Gil Scott-Heron was? Do you know who Nina Simone was? We got to keep their voices alive. So every time I raise my voice, I just want folk to hear their voices coming through a cracked vessel like me and saying, ah, oh, that radical tradition is still alive. And it's still alive in you, still alive in me. We're trying to make sure people have access to it to the best of our ability.
Well, I really appreciate your comments in that regard, because that actually moves me to my next question. How does a radical activist go from trying to force the empire to change from outside to trying to change the empire from within, from the position of the head of the empire?
Well, you didn't become very much like a Mary Lou Williams. You see, you're part of a collectivity. So you can write Black Christ of Andes, and okay, you are in a certain sense a leader. I don't believe in leaderlessness, but every leader is, in the language of Ella Baker, someone who is so organically connected to the group, to the community, to the collectivity, that you, when you step in, you are part and parcel, an extension of a larger movement. Because only a radical mass movement can engage ultimately in the dismantling of empire, ultimately in the fundamental transformation of a predatory capitalist society, ultimately in the fundamental change of a white supremacist and male supremacist society. That is what we call revolution. Revolution is what? It is the sharing of power, the sharing of resources, the sharing of dignity, the sharing of callings, and being able to do that in such a way that you get these major shifts in power and you get redistribution of wealth downward. We've seen in the counter-revolution of the last 50 years, redistribution of wealth upward. Counter-revolution is what? Taking power away from the people, trying to convince us we're powerless, trying to convince us we ought to defer. And most importantly, my brother, and this is what is so important about what you've been able to do and what Glenn and Margaret and the others do. Fear. You see, fear. Fear is in some ways the major factor. When you break the back of fear, then it's a new day. Then it's a whole new day. One of the things about Brother Glenn, he was a fearless brother. Courage at the deepest level. And he learned it from Malcolm. He learned it from his father. He learned it from musicians of Ohio. And he learned it from his mother and others, you see. Fear. We've got a massive, massive, fearful community. Scared. Intimidated. Don't want to raise their voices. They can't even be true to the Johnson Brothers anthem of lift every voice. They'd rather be an echo. Thank God we didn't say lift every echo, which ain't nothing but an extension of a silo. And if you an echo, you and I know what? You ain't never gonna be no John Coltrane. You be imitating Johnny Hodges for the rest of your life. Mm-hmm. Monk told him, find your voice. Miles said, find your voice. You gotta find your voice. And when you find your voice, that's where your dignity is. That's where your defiance is. That's where your determination is. But the only thing that breaks the back of fear is love. You got to love something bigger than you. You got to love your mama and your daddy and your people and some grand ideal and love the people in all of their concrete forms, you see. That's what breaks the back of fear. And every freedom fighter is a great love warrior. Why? Because they had to come to terms with fear. And we know that Black love is a crime in a white supremacist civilization. So anybody who falls in love with Black people, get ready to be criminalized, get ready to be lied on, get ready to be misunderstood, get ready to be misconstrued, get ready to be engaged or targeted with character assassination or literal assassination. Hey, that's what love is. That's what love is. That's Marcus Garvey. That's Queen Mother Moore. That's Martin Luther King Jr. That's Diane Nash. That's James Lawson. That's Brother Stokely. They love the people enough to break the back of fear. And, you know, it's always a challenge, though, brother, because you had to pay a major cost. But you find joy in that, and that's the important thing. Very much like the great musicians, man, that the love they have for the music is so profound that they're willing to pay a major cost. Think of a Charlie Parker. You think of a Dorothy Donegan. You remember she's a piano player that the greatest jazz piano players of all time, Art Tatum, say, she's the only one to make me practice. Art Tatum, what you talking about? Who was Dorothy? Giant, played classical music for so long, shifted to jazz, and then became a student of Art Tatum. Broke the back of any kind of fear of exploring and continuing to grow and continuing to develop and mature. So it is with our freedom fighters. Look at Malcolm. He's continually growing all the time. All the time. But how do we break the back of fear? See, we've got that misleadership class that Brother Glenn was talking about. They shot through with fear, man. He's some of the most scared, intimidated folk you ever want to meet, no matter how much money and no matter how big their mansions and their cribs and living in vanilla suburbs, when it comes down to what kind of choices they really want to make for something. Too many of them are afraid.
Well, I want to get to that. I had a question specifically revolving around that, and it's going to discuss one of the postulates or ideas we have with this revolutionary podcast. This is a revolution podcast. I'm glad you brought that up. One of the biggest obstacles that you are going to find in your presidential run is going to be from the Black political class, or what Glenn Ford called the Black misleadership class. And I'm going to ask you a very blunt and direct question, because we've talked about this here. We've talked about this on other podcasts as well. How is it possible to have a true working class rooted black politics in America, if there is not an internal class warfare or conflict or challenge put to the black political class by the black proletarian and lumpen proletarian for their sheer unwillingness and utility to the power of empire and being an obstacle to black liberation, how can we truly have any kind of truth in the freeing of black people from this condition if we do not suggest, support, and advocate for that black warfare? And the reason I bring this to you, and this is why I appreciate you, is this is where we disagree, because I know you are a believer in the black unified community or the beloved community that comes out of the Garrett Convention in 72, and you speak in those terms. And I understand those terms. I am not as much an adherent of those terms, because I believe that that politics is what gave birth to the black political class. Oh, my brother, my sister, until you get that job working at Bank of America as a, you know, as an advocate for their policies, gentrifying Newark, New Jersey. You know, and that's why, as much as I appreciate your camaraderie, your camaraderie on a racial level, I find it problematic, because you know how serpentine most of these Negroes are.
Yeah. No, then you're absolutely right about that. And I appreciate these powerful questions, though, brother. Let me just say that this is no ordinary conversation and dialogue. I can tell you that. But no, first you just start off with the fact that in the capitalist society, in the capitalist world, class struggle is real. And that cuts across skin pigmentation, cuts across gender, sexual orientation, cuts across national boundaries. Class struggle is real. We go back to Gary in 1972, you know, we were just emerging out of a moment where we tried to break the back of American apartheid centered in the South, and the forms of Jim Crow Jr. and Jane Crow Jr. In the North. So you still had segregation in the North, you had outright apartheid in the South. So you're gonna have a very, very strong black consciousness. And I identify with that black consciousness. I come out of a black church, I come out of a black musical tradition. Mom and dad and everybody who shaped me and loved me and sacrificed for me were beautiful black people. But the class struggle is still real. Now, out of Gary, you got black politicians, but we also got a Mary Baraka when he went through his black nationalist stage and then understood class struggle was real and had his more class-based analysis, but always sensitive to struggles against the legacies of white supremacy and so forth. So that Gary conference, you know, was a heterogeneous gathering, right? You had a number of different forces, but the dominant forces was that of the black political class or the black political strata and the black bourgeoisie. You're absolutely right. And that's why we have to tell the truth about them. That's why, again, Brother Glenn and the other Black Agenda Report and others, but especially Brother Glenn, was so explicit about the Obama years, because Obama was a sign and a symbol, not simply an isolated individual, but a sign and symbol of the consolidation and the triumph of the black political strata within the American empire to do what? To protect Wall Street, to protect the militarism abroad, to continue dropping those drones on innocent people, to continue to be in unity with an apartheid like Israel against Palestinians undergoing indescribable evil, to expand AFRICOM on the continent, to downplay the entree of the Haitians vis-a-vis the Europeans and so, or even Indians from India and so forth, when we talk about immigration, you see. So that you ended up with these black faces in high places, that was a consequence of a class struggle in which, you're absolutely right, the black politicians actually moved to the very top, but the structure remained the same, the empire remained the same, Wall Street domination remained the same, mass incarceration continued to expand, grotesque wealth inequality continued to kick in. And what happens? You get a Black Lives Matter movement under black president, black attorney general, black homeland security. All three, those are powerful positions in the U.S. empire. Not the most powerful, because the permanent government of any capitalist society is big business, big money. But those political offices, powerful ones, all of them black, but can't even begin to deliver on the basic needs of black poor and working people. Class struggle is real. Class conflict is real. So I'm actually agreeing with you in terms of the trajectory of Gary, but the dominant trajectory was one of the black middle class politicians moving into high places. But you had a number of radicals who began to bring critique to bear of that. Of course, and Adolph Reed, of course, has been quite consistent in his critique of this. Gerald Horn, you know, you think of towering black leftist intellectuals as well, who've been very critical of this. Angela Davis, of course, saw it very, very early.
Well, I appreciate your candor. I mean, I'm glad you're willing to see the kind of the conflict I see with the ideology and the methodology of addressing those class divisions while yet trying to reach out in solidarity with people who come from those class coteries as well. Because I feel that once you give them sugar, they're going to start to suck the blood from you as you give them an opportunity.
Wow. Yeah, that's real. But what I'm saying, does it make sense to you though, brother?
Yeah, no, I understand where you're coming from, brother. I understand how the trajectory, I mean, as someone like yourself, I was merely a child in those years. I mean, you were an adult coming to your young adulthood, seeing these things transpire in your own face in real time.
Exactly.
So understanding the emotional sentiment of the time, there is such a thing as time and place when doing analysis. You know, yes, you can make the argument that what you read about a period of time and place 50 years later gives you a good precipice of what exactly was happening. But that's never going to replace the experience of being in that time and place and seeing things with your own eyes and understanding what motivated people's emotions in those spaces to see how they got caught up in what they did. And some people may have gotten caught up in a good idea. Some people may have got caught up in a bad idea. But the thing is, though, nonetheless, people got caught up.
And keep in mind, my brother, the context, one of the dominant forces of the context, alongside the co-optation and the incorporation of the black misleadership class, as Brother Glenn would put it, is repression. You see, we can never downplay the role of vicious repression, incarceration, and assassination that so many of our love warriors, Mumia right now still going, we get H.R.A.P. Brown, Imam Al-Hamein in Arizona, we just wrote a pamphlet just a year or so ago trying to make his situation more visible. Or Saada Shakur, I mean, of course, if I was president, I would pardon all of them. But I would pardon Julian Assange, I would pardon Edward Snowden, because they're all political prisoners who tried to tell the truth, Leonard Peltier and so forth. But the level of repression and surveillance and being crushed, we shall never forget Bobby Hutton's death 2 days after Brother Martin's death, right? 17 years old, Oakland. I know Brother Jason would say he's from Oakland. Bobby Hutton's right there, you see. Fred Hampton, we can go on and on and on. You see, that's real. And therefore, you know, the FBI and the CIA and the others, man, these are some serious gangsters, man. I'm telling you, they're some serious thugs, man. They will crush you in a second. That's again why whatever fear is coming our way, if you don't have that deeper love that allows you to still invest some kind of trust and confidence in the capacity of the people to fight even after you're gone, so you can leave a legacy such that your spirit is at work in their bodies, hearts, minds, and souls, in their movements, not just in their personhoods, but in their movements, in their families, in their music. You see, musicians are the vanguard of the species, brother. That's all we had of the 244 years of the most barbaric white supremacist slavery in the history of the world. Against the law for us to learn how to read and write. It's against the law for us to get together and organize. Against the law for us to worship God without white supervision. All we could do was what? Steal away at night, form a ring shout, hold hands and lift our voices. and create those beautiful spiritual songs that will be sung until the end of time. That's part of our tradition. It's a distinctive tradition, and it produces the greatest tradition of the 20th century, which is the Black musical tradition. There's no other tradition in the barbaric 20th century that has been deeper in terms of creativity, deeper in terms of fortitude, deeper in terms of courage. And that's why it has penetrated every nook and cranny of the world, not just because it's part of the American cultural imperial apparatus, but when people hear the music, the blues and the jazz and the rhythm and blues and the hip hop and the ragtime and everything else. Me and Jason was talking about Rick James, Black punk, well, whatever it is, we ain't got no categories for it. But something is coming out of the heart, minds, and souls of a hated people that has such deep love coming out of the hearts and minds and souls of an unfree people that is so free. It's like the connection between I Have a Dream of Martin King and Zoom by the Commodores. Those are freedom dreams in the language of Robin Kelly. That's what it is. That's the anthem of the brothers I've taught in prison for 41 years. That's their song, Zoom. Why is Zoom? Freedom dreams. I'm trying to get some distance from all of this hatred and terror and give an idea of what life can be like when we're free, we respect each other, treat each other right, create a free society with its democratized institutions and structures. You see, that's for me the crucial thing to never, ever, ever forget.
No, I understand that. And as someone who has been a long time aficionado and appreciator of Black cultural production and music, I see the sentiment. But what has happened to me, as much as I've gotten deeper in my dialectical materialist, of how empire and capital uses Black cultural production to further its own ends, its own utility, and further the subjugation of Black people, I begin to ask, and I say this respectfully, and we can disagree, does essentializing Black people as cultural producers not validate them as something, quote unquote, exotic and different that gives fodder to racialist connotations? It's like, oh, look at those Negroes. They make such wonderful music. In other words, when we do the things that we say about ourselves, like, it's our music that makes us so special. Well, how would we feel if David Duke started saying that? Those are their Negroes in their music that's so wonderful. I often think that sometimes when we essentialize ourselves in our cultural production, which is something that is always, you'll never hear white intellectuals chastising Black people for singing hymns of the greatness of their cultural production. You never will. Why? Because it fits into the panoply of stereotypes the Western world has about Black people. I mean, what was the old statement from the early 20th century? Black people are the females of the races. Why? Because they're so culturally and artistic and they make these wonderful things. This is not to say that we should shy away from the cultural productivity that we have. But when we essentialize Blackness as a cultural producer, does that not serve the ends of those people who say, well, of course they can. They're Black. They play drums so wonderful. They've been doing it for hundreds of years.
No, that's very powerful, brother. And I hope that all of your wonderful listeners take in your insight and your wisdom. I would say this, that one, we should never essentialize, because these are all historical products. Right? See, when you essentialize, you're saying something that's ahistorical. You see, these are historical products of music that we produce. The way in which Black people walk and talk and preach and so forth. And so all those are forms of struggle at the deepest visceral and cerebral level. So we don't want to centralize it all. Two, that they're all truths are subject to multiple deployment by powers that be. Truths can be used by liars. You see, that great insights can be used by mendacious folk. You see. So that when, let's say, a David Duke, and it's interesting because when I was in Charlottesville, and we only had about 18 of us at the end singing This Little Light of Mine, right? If it wasn't for Antifa, we would have got crushed like cockroaches, right? But we right there with all the right wing, not just right wing, but neo-Nazis and the Klan and so forth. Well, some of them listen to Motown in the park, man. I mean, so your point is real. Now they're gonna listen to Stevie Wonder and at the same time want to kill Stevie Wonder and all the folk who produced him, me and you and the others, right? But part of it is that the genius of Black people is just so profound, not because we're Black, it's because what we have created under slave, neo-slave, hood, ghetto conditions. And it is, in that sense, an element of decolonizing, because it's an affirmation of our humanity, no matter how much we have dehumanizing forces coming at us. That truth can be used by the David Dukes. That truth used by the neoliberal culture industry, right? I mean, who ran the clubs and the nightclubs? How come Coltrane was trying to create his own label? How come Curtis Mayfield founded Kirkdom? How come Otis Redding was trying to get his own label? They knew that when it came to economic power, that they were being exploited. But at the same time, they also knew they were coming from a tradition that was so rich, it would be used in a variety of different ways. And part of the spiritual and cultural welfare warfare going on today, especially among our young people, is the dumbing down of our music. I was blessed to write a song with a genius named Bootsy Collins called Freedom on his album, Funk Capital of the World. But Freedom, F-R-E-E-D-U-M. Now, he came up with the title. That's part of his genius. But we worked out the song in the studio, right? Meaning what? The dumbing down of our music, the dumbing down of our culture to try to convince us that the only alternative is to accommodate to the status quo. The only alternative is to be well-adjusted to injustice, well-adapted to indifference. So that the battle over our music, the three albums that I did, each time I went to the different heads of the labels, they say, we want G-string music, Wes. We don't want all this freedom crap. We got rid of that stuff in the 60s. I said, oh, really? Bring in a little Talib Kweli. I brought in some Jill Scott. I brought in the greatest soul singer of the younger generation, Gerald LaVert. Last song he did before he died young. We brought in Lenny, brought in Brother Lenny from Tower of Power and the others. I said, no, we're going to get this out anyway. Thank God Steve McKeever did. He was in, it still is head of Hidden Beach, but he was in with Jill Scott at the time. Meaning what? That's a battle. That's a spiritual and a cultural battle. Precisely because of your powerful insights. So that the right wing or the liberals or the imperialists or whatever can say, oh Lord, that Michael Jackson can dance, that Prince can move, that James Brown is beyond description. Well, they right, but they're not right for the reasons they put forward. They're right because there is no James Brown, there is no Aretha Franklin without the collective struggle of a great people in the face of overwhelming forces of hatred and terror and trauma, but never allowing the hatred and terror and trauma to have the last word. The challenge is, how do we translate that kind of artistic courage into political courage? See, that's the shift. If our intellectuals had the same courage as a Ben Webster, we ain't even talking about Charlie Parker yet, but a Ben Webster, so sharp and sweet and sophisticated and gut bucket subtlety and so forth. Hey, and free, oh man.
You know, back
we'd have Glenn Ford running all over the country, man.
I'm enjoying this conversation so much. I feel like I regret that I have to go back to the banality of the questions that I prepared.
No, deal with the presidential election,
unfortunately, because you know I could enjoy having this dialogue and debate with you, or this discussion about the nature of what Black cultural production means in American empire.
Can we bring Dr. West back on at some point to have a discussion about the class politics of disco?
The class, ooh. I'm sure he would love to do that. We had a great
absolutely. I come in humble because I know I can learn from Brother Jason himself. Tower.
you heard him say it. Y'all heard him say it. I just wanted to, now back to your regularly scheduled programming.
Well, I gotta let me take you to a couple of questions here because I gotta get your point here. I gotta get your opinion on this. This is very important. Do you believe that there is a global dialectic that has worsened since the 2008 crash that has politics in large parts of the West to be stuck in a dialectic between neoliberal technocrats or liberal globalists, as some would call them, and right-wing reactionaries typified by Donald Trump, Marine Le Pen in France, Viktor Orban in Hungary, and the Brexit supporting faction in British politics? In other words, do you agree that global Western politics, maybe not only exclusively in Western powers, because we have Bolsonaro also in Brazil, we have Modi in India. Do you agree that particularly post 2008 crash, you know, not to fall on the false quote of Lenin that says capitalism is the initiator of fascism, because that is a false quote. It's not a true quote, even though ideologically it does wax well in the consciousness of those on the left. Do you agree that the world is moving into this very dangerous binary or dialectic where there is a kind of almost kind of like empire-like battle between the neoliberal, between the reactionary right, the new reactionary right, and the global neoliberal technocrat?
Yes. I think for me, it's very important to always begin with historical context and the dynamic factors in historical context. 1492 to 1945, that's the age of Europe. With those nations between the Ural Mountains and the Atlantic Ocean tried to reshape the whole world in light of their image and their interests. That was European imperial expansion. 1945, it's over. Indescribable evil in the concentration camps. African decolonization emerging with tremendous power. All of the European empires beginning to implode. And what emerges? The Soviet Empire on the one hand and the American Empire on the other. 1991, Soviet Empire goes under, and all of its satellite countries had already gone under in 1989. What's left? The American Empire, the only superpower. 800 military units around the world, military expenditure more, 10 times more than the next 10 times more than the next 10 countries. China only got 5, Russia got 30. We got over 800 military units around the world. But what happens? We are now witnessing the decentering of the American Empire, just like we saw the decentering of European empires in the 1940s. Well, what happens when you decenter an empire? Well, not only the worst comes back, people get nostalgic about when it was quote unquote great. Great for who? Not indigenous peoples, not working peoples, not black folk and so forth. It was great in its own nostalgic eyes, given the role of big money, big capital, and having workers, women, especially black folk and other people of color, indigenous people, under control. Those days are over in terms of perception, and they're hanging on for dear life. And the only alternatives, and they're both class wars, neoliberalism, that's what Clinton was all about. That's what the Democratic National Council was all about, all the way through Obama and now Biden, or increasing neo-fascism. That's flowing out of the Dixiecrats, which used to be Democratic, right? 1945 with Strom Thurmond and company. And then George Wallace gets 13.5% of the votes on a white supremacist platform in 1968. This is after Brother Martin was murdered, right? And he's third party. So the Republican Party picks that up, and we end up, you're absolutely right, with this counter-revolution, with this wavering between neo-fascism and neoliberalism, but both are forms of class war against working people. One is explicitly white supremacist and xenophobic. The other is still deeply racist. You can't have a mass incarceration regime, disproportionately black and brown, where the Biden himself was an architect, without him being complicitous with one of the great crimes of against humanity. That's what our prisons are. Like sites of barbarity. I've been in there for 41 years. People ought to be ashamed that they even exist in America or any other place. You know what I mean? And they flow out of our hoods. The richest nation in the history of the world, and 63% of the population living paycheck to paycheck, and 40% of the black children living in poverty. That is spiritually sick. It's obscene.
when they write the history of the fall of the American Empire, they're going to say, where were the people fighting? Where were the voices? Couldn't they see these people suffering? Couldn't they see the social misery of the masses? And if they only see the black middle class in white in the White House or the black middle class in mayorships and so forth, they gonna say, damn, y'all was some cowardly folk. You didn't tell the truth. And the condition of truth is to allow suffering to speak. That's what we learned from our musicians, brother. You can't tell the truth and sing a song, Good Morning Heartache. No, no. You're going to have some suffering speaking, man. Or it's going to be trite and empty and hollow. You could take that to the vanilla side of town. We want the truth at the Apollo.
Well, let me ask you this in regards to the truth and, you know, prison conditions.
Dr. West is not going to forgive me for my blasphemy for coming at black music, man.
We together on this, bro. I mean, look the way they use Louis Armstrong, man. He's one of the greatest revolutionary figures of the last 150 years. He's out there playing for the empire, right? Yeah. He's ambassador for the empire.
In the Katanga province.
He's sitting at high C in West End Blues for his mama. That ain't for the empire, brother. They're using him for the empire, but the music itself has the capacity to actually be a critique of it, even though no doubt they're trying to deploy it in such a way that it's just American dream and the old traditional liberal project. But we'll go right ahead, Brother Jason.
I mean, we also, there's a lot of underclass ideology also too in a lot of black popular music, you know, the hip hop. A lot of hip hop definitely embraces a certain underclass ideology. These wayward kids are this way because they don't have daddies. Right. We definitely had a lot of black cinema in the 90s. Boys in the Hood, in my opinion, is a, you know, commercial for the 1994 crime bill. And then maybe Menace to Society doubles down on that. You know, what say you about that when it comes to, you know, kind of the black culture industry? You know, I did a video essay. The last one I did was called Same As It Ever Was about black cinema. I don't think much has changed from the 70s to Wakanda. You know, why are we celebrating Wakanda like it's this great place when this technologically advanced empire that has never seen slavery is still fighting on the savannah on the backs of animals with spears? There seems to be a certain image, regardless if kings and queens, like why are we excited about a monarchy that has to have a bloodline for you to be a part of it? So, you know, what is it about our cultural production that almost seems stuck in either an over-glorification of 1972 or, you know, we haven't changed much from Shaka Zulu when you look at something like Black Panther. What does a movie look? I'm a comic reader. I'll watch another sequel, but I do understand, you know, the issues with these.
No, indeed. I hear exactly what you're saying. I think one way of looking at it is zero in on that year, 1972, was Superfly. The so-called black exploitation movies. And then listen to the music of the genius of geniuses, Curtis Mayfield, the West Side of Chicago. I'm so glad I got my own. You see, Pusha Man, the humanity of Fred, the critique of the implicit ideology of everybody obsessed with the 11th commandment, thou shalt not get caught, only concerned about commodities, possessing your soul by means of commodities. You're absolutely right. See, it's one thing to depict and to describe in moving images and sound the various forces at work in the very impoverished areas of our precious hoods. And I grew up in the ghetto, but that's Donny Hathaway. We have a whole lot of love and resistance going on in the ghetto, whereas the hood's got some, but not as much as we had. That's a major shift. We had a neighborhood in the ghetto. The hood doesn't have as many neighbors as it ought. But it's one thing to depict it, but it's another thing to have a 1994 crime bill that says instead of quality schools, quality housing, quality education, quality jobs, we're going to give these folk containment, suppression by the police, and we sending so many of them, too many of them innocent, to mass incarceration. There's a step between, on the one hand, the depiction of what's going on, and then the response. You see, John Singleton, who I actually didn't know, but we've had many, many conversations, if you'd ask him whether he would accept the response to the depiction of his film being mass incarceration, my hunch would say no, he wouldn't agree with that.
I mean, so look,
I'm trying to be an artist and lay bare what's going on in the hood.
There's a difference
between laying out the depiction and the response. You see what I mean? Mm-hmm. And you see, when you get Curtis Mayfield's music, was the response to the hood. And we listen to that album. Oh, it's so much dignity, so much truth telling, so much visionary energy. You agree with me on that?
Look, you're talking to a Curtis Mayfield fan, right? Oh, so, Lord. And I'm from down the road from you, right? We want to talk about hoods. I'm from down the road, and I was born in Oakland, grew up in Richmond, California. So,
oh yeah, well, so and y'all had the Natural Four. The Natural Four was chosen by Curtis Mayfield. You remember when he had his show? That was the first group.
So you know,
first
I'm
group that he had on. Can this be real? Be
I remember those that time. But you know, I remember that moment in the 80s and the 90s, and I remember how violent it was. And I also remember that the community as a whole, you know, if we want to talk about a movie that, you know, is extremely problematic, but there's a scene in that movie that I think is probably the most accurate portrayal of the discussions that were happening at the time when we talk about like crime bills, is a movie called Colors. Because there's a scene where there's like a community meeting. And the problem I have with Colors, of course, is that it depicts the police as technologically outnumbered by a superior force being gangs. And it was actually quite the other way around. But that scene is these people in the community going, look, we need more police because we got these fools shooting up the neighborhood. But we also don't want you messing with our kids because our kids aren't a part of this problem. And I remember, I mean, was it Ishmael Reed, I believe, is quoted in, I want to say about 91, as saying that he would, and I don't know if he feels this way today, it's been 30 years, that he wished 13-year-old crack dealers would get life sentences. And that was the way a lot of people looked at the problem. We weren't looking at it as, well, is it really just removing drug dealers from neighborhoods with longer sentences? And here we are about 30 years later in 2023, and I'm seeing a lot of the same rhetoric that I saw with a much less bad crime problem. What we're seeing today with, you know, property crime pales in comparison to the violence that we saw in the 80s and 90s. Not to say that that crime bill was justified, it's just different. But the rhetoric coming from concerned citizens and now a lot of Democratic politicians really, for me, mirrors the same rhetoric that we saw building up into three strikes and what you saw with the crime bill. And I know you were outspoken, and there wasn't a lot of people really pushing back against that crime bill. It was a very small minority of people at the time.
We were cutting against the grain in a serious way. And the same is true with the welfare bill that was signed at the same time. But keep in mind, I mean, you know, Brother Ishmael Reed, he's a literary genius and a giant, but he ought to be ashamed of himself for saying something like that. But what he said was on a continuum with the Black Congressional Caucus, most of whom voted for the same Strom Thurmond Joe Biden crime deal that Biden helped push through. Back to the Black misleadership class again. You see, that for them, the quickest way of dealing with this was to just get rid of these folks. They predators, that was the dominant language coming out of James Wilson and John Eluleo, the scholarship in inverted commas. And many of us were fighting against it, but we should also know, this is where the class question comes in, that I don't think Ishmael Reed would say that about his own son, you see. He's talking about the brothers somewhere else. We're not talking about Jack and Jill, young middle class black folk. Mm. No. You're not talking about the Martha Vineyard young people.
Mm,
God bless them. I'm a Christian, so I'm trying to love everybody. You know what I mean? But hey, I begin with the chocolate side of town. I begin with the least of these on the chocolate side of town. How you treat them, you treat your own kids the same way. That's what I got from my mother, Irene B. West of Shiloh Baptist Church, who was the first grade teacher and a principal who taught Vacation Bible School double every summer in the hood, Shiloh Baptist Church, where I went, and the Black Panther Party was right next door. And when we walked through the community, they grabbed her and said, Mrs. West, you helped teach me to read. You love me. You gave me a sense of possibility. They didn't have to join the church because we loved them. They were the same ones that later on would join the Panthers. So that's what I'm talking about. It's the folk who understand that Jamal and Letitia have exactly the same value as your middle class child who's black, who's on the way to Howard or Morehouse or Harvard or whatever ruling class or elite institution they go to. And I'm not putting them down. I'm just equalizing. I'm leveling them. And there's no doubt that if the level of mass incarceration was hitting black upper middle class children, we wouldn't have had mass incarceration. That's a fact. And that's a class reality, because they didn't believe that Jamal and Letitia had the same value as their own kids. And I tell my kids from the day they were born that you see that brother and sister over there hanging out on the block with his pants falling down, he got exactly the same value as you. Dang, how are you? Well, that's what my Christian faith is all about. You don't have to be a Christian believer. You can be a Buddhist like Bell Hooks. Same thing. You can be an atheist like C.L.R. Jakes. Same thing. You could be like Glenn Ford. And Glenn Ford was kind of spiritual because he was a musically oriented brother, but he wasn't religious in any traditional sense. We come together on that.
Well, Dr. West, we are over an hour, and the Mau Mau hour is an hour. And I got to tell you something right now, brother. We got to have you back on the show to talk
about. I'm coming back, brother. You just called. I come running, man. I tell you that right now. Definitely.
We're going to go with the outro. And we, after the outro, we're going to further a little connections to make sure we have direct access to you. And we got to have you more to not only hear you voice out your presidential election bid, but get much more deeper into the philosophical conundrum of black life in the 21st century. I'd like to hear more of your discussion about that, the class context of American life and the American political scene, popular culture from a class and cultural analysis, historical facts and figures from individuals past and forward, the role of the black left in the contemporary left and why it's been sadly ignored.
Yes. That's so true. But again, though, brother, I just want to salute you for keeping alive, you know, the revolutionary wing of the grand tradition of a great people. Now, again, I'm not essentializing that, because I know we got some black thugs and gangsters dead up, and I got a lot of thuggery and gangster in me. But I can tell you one thing, that when it comes to truth telling, justice seeking with style and with a smile and with a spirit and with a rhythm and with a poly-like syncopation, the black revolutionary tradition, man, is a beautiful thing. It's a beautiful thing. That's what you all represent, you and Brother Glenn and Margaret and the others, goes all the way back, man, 400 years.
I appreciate the appellation, brother. I appreciate all of the wonderful things that you have said. Does the crew have anything they want to say in parting to Dr. Cornel West?
Tucson?
We need to talk about house music.
Oh, I got a house album coming out in about 9 months, my dear sister.
I know it.
You heard about that. We were just at the House of Yes in Brooklyn just the other night.
We've done multiple shows on house music and then kind of where it comes from, and definitely the class politics behind house music, Lord, with some of the bigger
Brother
producers.
Frank and them, Lord have mercy. No, we
definitely.
But I mean, I come in humbly because I'm old school. Y'all know that now. I'm old school.
Yeah.
I'm the Dramatics and Del Phonics and Main Ingredient and Enchantment and Temptations and the Emotions and the Jones Girl. And we ain't got to Earth, Wind, and Fire yet. So I'm a real old school. But I love my house music and me and Brother Brandon finishing up on this album. We already released 4 songs on it. But Got That Hope is one of them. Fire from James Baldwin is another. But no, but house music, again, is very much like the blues. It's become appropriated by a number of brothers and sisters who are not black in terms of the reception. But the origins and the beginnings are shot through with the best of those features of the black musical tradition, though. They really are.
All right.
Well, thank you very much for taking the time to talk with
us. Dr. West, listen, man, we're going to have you on. If not, we have the Mau Mau that's going to be the last Wednesday of the month, of course, in August. But we may have to do a set. What's your schedule like on Saturday?
This is a production. You can't have a production conversation on air.
I'm getting ready. I'm getting on a plane on Saturday. We getting ready. Because like I say, we haven't had our events yet. We're building for Mississippi and things. But I'm on a plane. But what I can do, I'm going to be on the road until the beginning of September. We can start the fall off with some fire tied to the musical tradition and how any political activist who is worthy of themselves and of the tradition can connect to our talk about what's going on.
The real question is, Dr. West, is Earth, Wind, and Fire black yacht rock?
Oh, Earth, Wind, and Fire, man. Lord have mercy. Lord, I was just with
Bill Bailey. Frankie Beverly black yacht rock? Man. That's the real
Jason question. Jason is blaspheming traditions. He calls Earth, Wind, and Fire and Frankly Baby of Beverly black yacht rock.
Black yacht rock.
The statement is that they are the music of, boat shoe wearing, upper middle class, Moet drinking, going on the vineyards type Negroes. And that music is divorced from the black proletariat. So he calls it black yacht rock.
Jason knows when he listens to Devotion. Devotion. The beat of Devotion goes back to the black church, and he grew up in Memphis and the South Side of Chicago.
I grew up in a black church in Richmond, California, McLaughlin Temple. My grandfather was a Kojic bishop, actually.
Yes.
But when I hear Badia, I picture Negroes on a boat. I picture Negroes on a boat.
I know you're right about that, but Devotion's a different kind of sound, though. That's a different jam now. Earth, Wind, and Fire is heterogeneous, man. They could get new age 1 second, and then Phil Bailey could take you to church the next minute. Ooh. Then they off with the hippies the next minute. Then they back with Crosby, Still, and Nash the next minute. And as you know, Maurice White played the drums for Ramsey Lewis for 4 years, right?
Beast.
That's fair. But,
exactly. So that he's got his connections with that jazz tradition. I put on
Philip Bailey.
But he's got all of those elements. But this is the kind of rich tradition, given the geniuses that they are, that we could get into. But I hear exactly what you're saying.
It's partially tongue-in-cheek. I just want Pascal to feel bad whenever he puts on Frankie Beverly. That's all. I mean, whenever Pascal puts on his boat shoes and is walking around Miami Beach with his mint julep and a parasol, I want him to feel bad as he's listening to Frankie Beverly.
You
are now.
We're gonna do something in the fall, no matter what.
Listen, brother, you are now. This is you are now. Let me tell you, This Is Revolution podcast team family, man. So you've been here once. We're gonna have you on again, brother. You are, we keep you in rotation for sure, brother. This has been.
You honor me to have me back, and you honor me really, and I salute you all.
Thank you, Dr. West. Thank you, everybody, checking it out. And Toussaint, what do we say when we leave?
We are out.
Peace.
If I tell any secrets of the Mau Mau, this oath will kill me. If I am called in the night and refuse to come, this oath will kill me. If I see anyone steal white man's property, I must help him. I must hide what he gives me and say nothing, or this oath will kill me.
The whole system in this country, the economic system, is such that Jobs are scarce. Automation is limiting jobs. It's decreasing jobs. And as automation eliminates the job opportunities, legislation will not create job opportunities. All it will do is bring about friction and hostility between the two races.
You see, there will be no progressive revival if black folks are not deeply involved in it.
I will obey all orders of the Mau Mau, or this oath will kill me.